just a few days past a day of love in our culture, Valentine's Day, and it feels a little fitting to be in the book of Ruth around Valentine's Day, because the book of Ruth has all the pieces of a great love story. And I was actually thinking about how there's so much connection point between the book of Ruth and the storyline and a Hallmark Christmas movie. There's a similarity to it. A Hallmark Christmas movie, big picture, all the stories are essentially the same, and they go a little like this. There's a woman who has a highly successful career in the big city, and she has family that lives out in the country, and she goes over Christmas to visit them. And she stumbles upon a bookstore or a coffee shop or a Christmas tree farm that's run by a guy who's lived there his whole life and is well respected in the community, but the business is just kind of struggling and barely getting by. And a bunch of random circumstances come about where these two are forced to interact time and time and time again over the course of like 3 days. And those 3 days cause the woman at the end of all that to decide, you know what, that life that I had in the city is not the life I want anymore. I am supposed to be with this man. And she leaves the life that she's always dreamed of high success, to instead enter into this rural community and into a marriage with this man. And now that business is highly successful because of all of her extra expertise in helping it succeed. That's essentially a Hallmark Christmas movie. And the book of Ruth is this love story that has all of those kind of same things weaved in it. There's tragedy, there's loss, there's despair, there is triumph, there's hope, there's romance. And so we could have another kind of tagline for the book of Ruth and our series on it. It would be like this: the book of Ruth, better than a Hallmark movie. That's our series for these next few weeks, and it's totally true. Last week we read through the entire story, almost 100 verses, and today we're going to look at 5. But our big theme from last week was that we look at the finite details of our lives and we can lose sight of the bigger picture of the story that God is telling. And we can recognize through the book of Ruth that it's the tiny little decisions and choices that dictate really the direction of our lives. And God is using those intimate details to tell a bigger, grander story of redemption. And this kind of these themes of God's sovereignty, his power, God's providence, the circumstances that he brings into our lives is really what the book of Ruth invites us to consider. And as I was thinking about those themes, I stumbled upon an old hymn written in the 1700s by a guy named William Cowper. The hymn is called God Moves in a Mysterious Way. Some of you might know this hymn, but the backstory of William's life makes this hymn all that more impactful. He was born in the 1700s, came into prominence around the same time as John Wesley and George Whitefield, but around the age of 21, he fell into a deep depression that marked his life off and on for the rest of his life. And at one point, he started a career in government, and he had a mental breakdown. And he was put into something back then that was called an insane asylum. And after a few years, he was released, and he went to live with a family friend who went to church with a guy named John Newton, who was the pastor. Now, John Newton wrote the famous hymn, Amazing Grace. And so it was John Newton and his leadership, with William Cowper now as a part of his church, that really turned William's love from poetry and nature into a gift of writing hymns. And it was during William's time at John Newton's church that he wrote the hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. And here's just the first two paragraphs of the hymn. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds of never failing skill, he fashions up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. And it's that first paragraph that particularly stood out to me, where he says he plants his footsteps in the sea. And what he's helping us picture is God is exercising his sovereign will. He is in control. He is powerful enough to be dictating the acts and events of life, but his footprints, his activity, are in the sea. And those of us that have been to the ocean know that when you're by the ocean and your footsteps are along the edge of the waves, eventually they disappear, right? And especially if you're deep into the ocean, if you were to step down into the bottom of the sea, it would be the current that would cause that footprint to almost immediately disappear. As soon as you see it, it's gone. God's sovereignty in our lives and in our experience can be a little bit like that. We struggle to see what God is doing. We can't make sense of every action that is brought into our lives by the Lord. And here in the book of Ruth, God is really pulling back the curtain in the intimate details of the characters' lives. In this story, we see God orchestrating his redemptive story through them. And the invitation then is for us to trust him, even when we can't see the big picture. And so today we begin our now slow walk through the story. Last week we read the whole thing. Today we are looking at literally five verses. Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. And this is the word of the Lord. Now, I realize this doesn't seem like much, especially after last week, but there is so much in these five verses that will be especially important context and background for us to be able to more understand the significance of the story that the book of Ruth has to tell. But one of the challenges of going through this book really slowly over the next 7 weeks, we're going to slowly work through four chapters of the book of Ruth. One of the challenges is, now that we've read the whole story last week, and you can read the story for yourself and get all the way to the end, we, as we hone in on specific parts of the story, are going to immediately want to resolve it. We're going to want to jump to the end and recognize everything works out great, but in the intimate parts of the story, there is a lot of hardship and struggle. And we have to embrace this tension of staying in the struggle before we just immediately resolve it down the line. And this helps us then experience the light of God's presence, because we have first embraced the darkness of our and their despair. And it really starts with that despair in the very beginning part of verse 1, which highlights the downward spiral of self-seeking despair. All that is said in the first part of verse 1 when it says, in the days when the judges ruled. It is emphasizing the book of Judges from the Old Testament. And now to get there, to understand where we're at in the context of Israel's history, it would be helpful to start at Genesis and work our way quickly to Judges and where the people of Israel are. So the book of Genesis obviously starts with God creating everything, and God chooses a family in which he announces his presence into the world, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then eventually Joseph, who allows the family to transition to Egypt, where hundreds of years take place, and this Israelite family of 12 sons eventually becomes a great nation and becomes enslaved to the people and the government of Egypt. And then we have the book of Exodus, which we studied a year ago. And we have Moses, who rises up as a leader for the people. And it allows overcoming Pharaoh, allowing God's people to be released from their place of slavery. And through the Red Sea, they're led into the wilderness. And they wander in the wilderness for a long period of time. And at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, after all of that wandering, they're on the brink, they're on the edge of the promised land. And that takes us into the book of Joshua, where the people enter into the promised land and overcome the people who were in Canaan as a sign of God's healing of the land instead of the destruction of the evil that had been there in that place. And then the book of Judges, they're in the promised land and they're learning how to live there. They're learning how to govern themselves. And the book of Judges is not a particularly pretty picture about the nation of Israel. It is a dark, maybe the darkest point in Israel's history is the book of Judges. It is a time of failure, of sinfulness, and it is a, as I put in the notes there, a downward spiral. And so I picture it kind of like this. It starts off with the people being sinful. They turn from God's way and go their own way. And this allows or forces God to oppress them, to hopefully wake them up to the reality of the consequence of their sin. And this causes the people to cry out and to repent. And God, in his kindness and his goodness, delivers them from the oppression that they're facing and brings them to a place of peace, usually through a new judge who's raised up to oversee the people. And this lasts for just a short amount of time before, again, the people go from a place of peace to sin. And this continues over and over again. And it's not just a cycle, it's a downward spiral, because if you read the book of Judges, it just gets worse and worse and worse. It starts with Ehud, and it goes to Jephthah and Samson, and by the end of the book, we have rape and murder taking place, and Israelites fighting with one another, and it all culminates at the very end of the book. The last verse of the entire book of Judges gives us really the theme statement of the book as a whole, when it says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit." Other translations translate that last part as everyone did what was right in their own eyes. What was right in their own eyes is what they saw fit. And isn't that a great description of how sin grows in our lives? We start off relating with God and wanting to honor him and seek out his ways and follow his commands, but then hardship and struggle comes into our lives. We begin to doubt God's goodness and start to look to our own inclinations as the way forward, not really wanting to honor the Lord, but instead choosing our own way. Martin Luther, back in the 1500s, described sin as man curved in on himself, looking only to his own needs. This is the picture of Judges, doing what is right in your own eyes. It's a picture of sin. Instead of looking to the Lord and seeking to honor him, now you are looking at yourself and in yourself as a way forward. And when you walk away from God and you live by your own standards, you walk into a place of ultimately destruction. And I think we see this in our own culture, which says you should be able to be whoever you want and live however you want as long as you're not harming anyone else. Just do whatever you want to do, be whoever you want to be, as long as it's not dangerous or harmful, go for it. But the problem with this is that eventually, when everyone does what is right in their own eyes, eventually, over time, in the downward spiral of sin, means ultimately everybody gets hurt. Ultimately, everybody is harmed. And so many of the struggles that you see taking place in our own lives and in our society are the ultimate reality of doing what's right in your own eyes. All of our marriage problems of leaving the faith, of jealousy and division in relationships, even lack of unity in churches, can all stem from one thing: doing right in our own eyes rather than following the commands and the teachings of the Lord. Our homes, our workplaces, our schools, our churches, they need one true king, which is Jesus. And when we seek to honor him and follow his way, we get to experience his righteousness and the unity that he brings. And in a broken, in a dark world, we have to crown him as Lord of our hearts and give glory to him alone. And when we do that, we get to walk into the blessing that he longs to give us. But that is not what happens in the book of Judges. The book of Judges is not a hopeful time. It is a terrible time. And that, in that situation, is when the book of Ruth takes place. And so throughout the book of Ruth, we're going to see what I think the Bible writers are trying to help us see is a contrast between the days of the judges, when people did what was right in their own eyes, and the book of Ruth, where we meet Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, who often as they operate as a foil, as an opposite to the time of the people of Judges. And one of the questions then for us to wrestle with is, am I more reflective of the days of the Judges, or am I more reflective of the integrity and the character of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz? And it then becomes a reminder to us that we can look out at our world and see all sorts of brokenness. But the challenge is not just to complain and gripe about how terrible our world is, but to instead embody the kind of godly character that we see take place in the book of Ruth. And that when we do that, God can use us to weave his story of redemption moving forward, despite all of the calamity taking place around us. And so far, we've covered half a verse. Let's continue on. The second half of verse 1 helps us see a desperate move to the enemy. A desperate move to the enemy. The second half of verse 1, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The second half of verse 1. It starts off by saying there was a famine in the land, and this is not just any famine. This is a famine taking place in Bethlehem. And what's interesting about that is Bethlehem is a Hebrew word that means house of bread. So in the house of bread, there is no bread. And God has not provided, and there's hardship coming among the people, God's people. And I think most of us don't really understand the plight of a famine. If in a couple hours I haven't eaten any food, I will say to somebody, more than likely, I am starving. But it's not true, right? Starving is a famine where you've had very little to eat, not for 2 hours, not for 2 days, but for 2 weeks. And you're not sure when you'll be able to eat again. Now put yourself in the position of Elimelech and Naomi as parents with children. They leave their home out of desperation, seeking a better place where they will be able to provide for their children. And we see the desperation because they go to Moab. They go to Moab, and the Israelites did not like Moab. Moab was an enemy of the Israelites because Moab has a checkered past. And you really have to start with the origin story of the Moabite people in the country of Moab to understand why. And it really takes us back to Genesis 19, where Lot, this is Abraham's nephew, has some daughters. And they're worried that they're not going to be able to get married and then have children to provide heirs for the family. And so they devise a plan to take matters into their own hands, where they're going to get their father, Lot, drunk, and then they're going to sleep with him in order to provide themselves an heir with the family. And this is what it says in Genesis 19, 36 and 37. Yes, this is in your Bible. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He is the father of the Moabites of today. So the Israelites do not exactly have a good origin story when it comes to the Moabite people, right? And this kind of ugly beginning continues on with Israel's relationship with the Moabites. In Numbers 25, there's Moabite women who travel into the camp where the Israelites are as they're facing a battle. They're in the middle of a war, and they seduce them and have all sorts of sinful activities and idolatry that takes place with them. And then even in the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 3, we learn about how the Moabites ruled over the Israelites for 18 years. And there's a lot more in the Old Testament that's negative toward Israel's relationship and the Moabites. And ultimately, what we see is that the Moabite people and the place of Moab became known in Israel as a place of immorality, a place of idolatry. They were enemies of Israel. And I share all that to say the famine that took place in Bethlehem was so severe that Elimelech and Naomi moved their family to the enemy out of sheer desperation. There had to have been nowhere else to go because this is where they chose to go. That's how desperate it was. 70 miles southeast of Bethlehem, a journey that would have taken a week to 10 days, is where they move, and then tragedy strikes. And that's really the last part of the text that I want to look at today. We see in verses 4 and 5 of Ruth 1, a woman who is left with nothing. She has nothing. Verses 4 and 5, after they lived there in Moab about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion, her sons, also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. So not only is Naomi in a land far from her home, but after spending now at least 10 years in Moab, she is now a widow and has no sons. And though she has daughters-in-law through marriage to her sons, they are childless, which means that the family has no male descendants in which to pass on the family name, the family assets like their land and their property, no one to carry it on, no one to provide for her. And in the ancient Near East, this is the greatest curse that any woman could experience in her lifetime. No extended family, no male family member to carry on the family name and the family property. She is in a dire situation. And in the original text, it even helps us understand this in verse 5. The verse 5 that I read out of the NIV says, "And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband." But in the original language, in the Hebrew, it is written not as Naomi, but as the woman. But the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. And what the original language is trying to help us understand is that she has lost her life. In a real sense, her life is over. She lost her identity because her family has disintegrated before her and she has nothing left to hold on to. They're trying to help us understand the gravity of the situation. And this is hard for us to understand because it's so different from our society. If there was an older woman today that became widowed, in no matter what the circumstance was, depending on her age, she might be able to draw from Social Security to provide for herself. She might have family assets that she and her husband had been saving for retirement. There would be other government sources of support, food stamps, Medicare, to be able to provide and care for her. In other words, there are all of these different safety nets that exist in our world today for a person who is in a dire situation to still be able to maintain a standard of living. But back then, that all was provided by the family. The family was the retirement plan, the health insurance, the food stamps, all of that was through the family. And so Naomi's struggle here in the book of Ruth comes from living in a society where men had both responsibility and authority. They were the ones that held on to the assets of a family. And so if there was no men left in a family, there would hopefully be another relative, distant relative, that could become the guardian redeemer. And this is a theme we'll talk about in the weeks to come. But a guardian redeemer then could save Naomi from her plight by buying the land and essentially buying her into his family to provide for her and allow for that family inheritance to continue on in the family. But here is Naomi. Remember, she is in Moab. She is 70 miles from any extended family that might even be able to help. So in Moab, she is in a really impossible situation. And in many ways, all of this kind of underscores for us that the book of Ruth, I think, could ultimately be titled the book of Naomi, because she is the one in the hardest, worst situation out of all of the characters that we're going to meet in this story. She is out of options. She has lost all of her safety nets. And it's through that struggle that we see God orchestrating his plan and moving it forward. His plan of redemption comes through her struggle. This situation for her is dire, and yet God is not done with her story. Recently, I reconnected with a friend of mine from high school who had reached out to me and wanted to ask me some opinions. He used to be active in the church, grew up in the faith. He's even been to this church many years ago, and knows that I'm a pastor, and now I would say he is very much a secular atheist, doesn't think God exists, and has bought the progressive agenda of our society as the path forward to life and a flourishing. And so our conversation was not easy. It was not particularly enjoyable, because now I am representative of things that he finds hateful and disgusting and not valuable to our society. But I was trying to kind of burrow down to what is kind of the core issue that he has with people of faith and faith in general. And so I was asking him questions, and he was asking me questions about the state of our society and culture today. And really, we got down to a point where he started to ask me questions about hardships that I've faced and hardships that he's seen. And ultimately, what I realized is that his question was like, how can God be worth following when there's so much hardship that exists in the world today? It's really a question of God's goodness in the midst of hardship. He's a firefighter paramedic, and so he's seen a lot of difficult things in life. He's seen a lot of difficult things. He's seen infants die. He's seen families blown up in car accidents. He's seen lives upended in an instant. A lot of hard, difficult things. And so he asked that same question that many of us have asked. God, where are you? God, where are you in this struggle that I'm facing that doesn't ever seem to get better? Why does my life look like this? Those are the kinds of questions that he asked. And he asked those questions for long enough where he began to doubt God's goodness. And once you doubt God's goodness through his provisions, then you have to find another pathway forward in life. If it's not through the Lord, ultimately what many of us do is we start looking to ourselves, like the book of Judges. We look and find what's right in our own eyes. And when you do that for long enough, eventually you will start embracing something that is bad as ultimately being good. That's the pathway of life, because suffering is a test of faith. And Naomi knew that test. And my friend has decided to go a different direction than Naomi ultimately goes. She knew that test because she buried her husband and her two sons in a foreign land and was left with nothing. She had to have been grappling with God's goodness in the provision of her life. And we see within her life then an opportunity to also, and for us, to question whether God is ultimately good when we're going through the struggles that we face. James 1 invites us to have a particular posture when it comes to hardships in life. It says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kinds. And ultimately, why should you have a posture of pure joy in the midst of struggle? Because that struggle will ultimately test your faith and produce a mature and deep and strong faith, a dependence on God that did not come in any way except through the struggle, a mature and a complete faith, which comes through the struggle. Earlier, I read William Cowper's hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. Later on in the hymn, I think he gives us a beautiful picture of what it looks like to be a person of faith in the midst of struggle. Toward the end of the hymn, he says, judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. You can see how his love for nature comes through the poetry of his hymn writing. And what he's helping us wrestle with is that even when there's famine in our lives, when we face loss and hardship, I can look around the room and start to call out the circumstances of difficulty that many of you are facing. Estranged relationships with family, with children. Cancer and other health struggles. Doubts about faith from people that you love. The struggle of embracing a job that you just feel like is a dead end. And we could go on, and we could each stand up and call out, here's my struggle, here's the thing that's difficult for me. We all have famine-like things in our lives. Some are worse than others. I would argue that Naomi's is worse than all of ours. Her plight, the struggle that she's in Ruth chapter 1, in the beginning parts, is overwhelmingly immense. But God is never absent in those struggles, and the sorrow and the struggle that we face is never the end of the story. God is always at work, carrying us through to the story that he longs for our lives to tell. And even when he feels distant, he is still longing to prove his faithfulness in your life as true. Psalm 145, verse 17 is a great verse that gets at this theme. The Lord is righteous in all his ways and faithful in all he does. Righteous in not just some of his ways, not just the ways that we like, but in all his ways, and faithful in all he does. The invitation of Psalm 145:17 is to trust, put our trust, our faith in the Lord. And it is suffering that ultimately tests our faith. But when we lean into the Lord in the midst of struggling, he deepens and enriches our faith as we trust in him all the more greatly. God is just as present in the suffering as in joy. And there are times in our lives when we don't always see his hand working. We don't always see his hand working. That was an intentional effect right there. We don't always see his hand in the moment, and we don't always understand his ways as he carries our lives forward, but we can trust his heart. And ultimately, the story of Naomi, even in the midst of struggles, is she saw the Lord's goodness in the midst of the famine in her life. And so I want to pray that over us as we transition toward a time of response. And I think this part of Ruth really forces us to kind of wrestle with our own lives. When have you experienced a season of suffering that made you question God's goodness or God's presence? And how, like Naomi, have you ever felt like God was against you, only to later find out that God was weaving the difficulties of your life forward to tell a bigger story? Those are questions that I think Ruth 1:1-5 invites us to ask. And as we move toward response, I'd like to pray for us with suffering and the weight of difficulty kind of on the forefront of our minds. So Father in heaven, we come to you as people who know the weight of sorrow. Maybe we can't relate in totality to Naomi, but like her, we have walked through bitter seasons where your presence feels distant and your purposes seem unclear. They are like the footprint at the bottom of the ocean that quickly disappears. But today we remember that you are God and you don't waste our pain and our struggle. You are always working, even when we can't see it. And so we are asking you to help us to trust your sovereign hand, especially when life feels overwhelming. Teach us to love you, not just for the blessings that you give, but for who you are, your faithfulness, your compassion, your redemption offered to us in Jesus. When we face hardship, remind us of the cross, where suffering and grace really come together to offer us a gift of eternal hope. And as we walk through our struggles, give us the grace to point others to your goodness. Help our faith to be an example and an encouragement, knowing that behind the difficulties of the providence that you bring into our lives, there is mercy and love. And so we trust you, God. We love you. Many of us have doubts, but help us to overcome with faith and resting in the promise that you are righteous in all your ways and faithful in all you do. We say all this in Jesus' name. Amen.